I'm very excited about this morning's teaching because I get to talk to about annoying people, and that's a real life passion of mine. So I'm very excited about this, but first of all, I want to thank Katie for last week. I don't know if I saw her around or not. Hey, there you are. Hey, thank you for that. That was wonderful. I want to jump into what I've been talking about the past few weeks. 3 weeks ago, we talked about expanding ourselves to see and welcome Jesus into skies. And then I follow that up by talking about how life can feel sort of out of reach for many of us, given that we've got full schedules and we're busy and feeling weary. Because what I've come to think is that for many of us, learning to see and show kindness to Christ through the stranger, it won't mean adding more and more things to life. And I talked very briefly 2 weeks ago about hospitality is the million boring little things we can do that help us expand and make space in our hearts so that we can begin to see and welcome Jesus in disguise. And someone said to me after that teaching, well, if there are a million boring little things, could you tell me about at least one or two of them? And that's what I want to do this morning. And I think one of the better ways to begin to understand the million boring little ways of hospitality and expanding ourselves to see Jesus in disguise is to examine what is called the little way of Therese Lisieux. Therese Lisieux was born in 1873, and she followed her two older sisters into the monastic life at a Carmelite convent in Normandy, France. And she went there in the year 1888, and from all we can tell from history, her time at the convent was very quiet and uneventful. She earned herself the nickname the Little Flower. But beyond that, her life seemed to be incredibly ordinary and remarkably dull. She participated in the life of community there, but she never stood out. And from what we know about her, she woke up on Good Friday, 1896, with blood in her mouth. And it led to a year-long battle with tuberculosis, and she passed away on September 30th, 1897. She was only 24 years old. Her short life was so completely unexceptional and underwhelming that one of her fellow sisters asked when she died, are we going to have anything to say about her at the funeral? And I feel like that might be the most saddest question in life to ask, are we going to have anything to say about her? And so when she died, there was no big accomplishments, there was no achievements to proudly talk about at her funeral. Yes, she had been nice and kind, but beyond that, her life was seemingly so dull and ordinary, no one could think of anything to say at her funeral. And yet, the remarkable thing is this, she went on to become a saint in the Catholic Church. She actually went on to become a doctor of the Catholic Church. She's only one of four women who hold that title. And so something happened between the time of her death and now. It seems she did do something remarkable. The little flower had done something, but what? Well, without any flattering words at her funeral, all that Therese left behind were a series of scattered writings and journals. And after her death, they were collected and published under the title The Little Flower, The Story of a Soul. And in it, Therese details what has become referred to as the little way of being Christian. And immediately it started getting attention. It's now earned her the reputation of being one of the most popular saints in Catholicism. What is it then about this little way that so many people have come to see refreshing and dynamic and powerful? Well, I want to explore that a bit this morning. Two things I would say immediately jump out. The first is what she left behind was this intentional habit-forming practice. Her little way was designed to speak into the, what I would say, the emotional trenches of our lives. So it focuses on changing how we feel about other people, not necessarily what we do or what we believe. And so it's a habit-forming practice that can change hearts and emotions. And she called this approach the science of love. And so what she left was this habit-forming practice. Consider it this way, so often I think what happens in the life of faith is that we take celebrities, stars of the faith, and we sort of point to them, we point to those people of what the Christian path should look like. So pick your favorite Christian author, activist, whoever that is for you. And so often we read their books, we read about them, and we think that's what being a Christian should look like. And I think the problem with doing that is it's basically like pointing to Kawhi Leonard and saying, you should shoot basketballs like that. By the way, I love the internet because of crazy conspiracies. I read about his buzzer-beating Game 7 shot, Kawhi Leonard. Some people have a conspiracy that there were magnets in the ball, and so the reason it hit the rim four times and went in is the NBA had planted magnets in the ball. Anyway, that's the internet for you. But it's true because it's like sometimes it feels like the Christian path is like pointing to someone like him and going, can you start shooting like that? And we know the reality is that's never going to happen. An NBA player has shot basketballs thousands and thousands of times, spent thousands of hours in a gym. You can't pick up a basketball and shoot like that from the beginning or even after your 1,000th time. And I think it's the same way with making space for God in our lives. We have to practice our way there and not expect to look like the stars, the celebrities of the Christian faith. The second thing about her little way is that it speaks into, I think, what we're already doing in life, not what we should be adding to life. And so when someone like my wife gets up here and talks about how the Christian path can speak into a very full schedule, how it can speak into an already full life, the little way of Therese does exactly that. Because here's the thing. Therese was in so many ways just like us. She wanted to do big and radical things. She wanted to be the Kawhi Leonard of the Christian world, but like many of us, she felt like her life was so dreary, so bland, so ordinary. She felt trapped by how small her life felt. And what she discovered after joining the convent is what I think many of us discover after we get our first job, our first mortgage, after having kids, or whatever it is. We spend most of our lives actually struggling through just the dramas of domestic life. And this is exactly what happened to her. She had a crisis of vocation. And there's a section of the book that deals with her thoughts on vocation. It's only 24 pages long, but it's quite something. It's changed many lives. And so feeling trapped by the smallness of life, feeling called to do bigger and more worthy things, she wrote this to Jesus. She said, I feel within me other vocations. I feel the vocation of the warrior, the priest, the apostle, the doctor, the martyr. I feel the need and desire of carrying out the most heroic deeds for you. I would shed my blood for you even to the very last drop. And of course, she's a mystic, so her language can feel very over the top. Can feel like, wow, that's a bit intense. But there's something about her words here that makes so much sense to me. Because I think essentially what she was feeling is what many of us feel and sense ourselves. I think we sense, oh, I could be so much more than I am. I feel within me that I could do so much more. These are the sort of things that keep us up at night sometimes, right? This idea, I feel called, I feel bigger than this, and yet I'm trapped by the ordinary. And for Therese, this was a massive struggle. She laid awake at night wondering, what is my call? What is my vocation? And I think this song sums up well this idea of feeling restless and struggling. This is Therese's life at this point. She's just struggling. What is it? All these grand desires, these dreams of hers that keep seeming to die and die. She's got all these vocations she feels called to, but she's trapped living as a cloistered nun, and then one day she has an epiphany. She's reading 1 Corinthians 12 and 13, and in 1 Corinthians 12, Paul is describing the different parts of the body of the church, how it functions as a body, but she couldn't figure out, reading this passage, what part of the body am I? She wasn't a priest or a preacher or a justice worker. She wasn't the mouth, the feet, or the hands of the church. So what was she? What part of the body was she? And then in chapter 13, Paul makes the observation that love is greater than all the spiritual gifts. Better than being the celebrity Christian. Better than being the hands of Jesus on the street. Better than being the lips of Jesus before big crowds. Better than being the feet of Jesus walking alongside those in need of mercy. Better than all of that is love. And with that insight, Therese has this epiphany breakthrough. Her spiritual vocation came to her in a flash. She was not the hands, nor the feet, nor the mouth, nor the eyes of Jesus. She was the heart. She expressed it this way. I finally had rest. Charity gave me the key to my vocation. I understood that if the church had a body composed of different members, the most necessary and most noble of all could not be lacking to it. And so I understood that the church had a heart, and that this heart is burning with love. Then in the excess of my delirious joy, I cried out, "Oh Jesus, my love, my vocation, at last I have found it. My vocation is love. Yes, I found my place in the church. I shall be love, thus I shall be everything." And so with that, she discovers her little way. And what she goes on to describe is little ways of incarnating love in our day-to-day experience with others. For her, there would be no grand gestures, no big adventures, no speaking to massive crowds, no radical mission of justice. For her, it was becoming love right here, right now. And I can almost sense the disappointment in the room. Really? Be love? That's the big idea, Brad. So underwhelming. Don't we talk about that every Sunday? It's like blah, blah, blah. Let's sing Imagine by John Lennon and go home. This isn't helping at all. But I want you to notice before we get into her little way what people who do the little way, how they describe it. Here's what Richard Beck says. He's huge on the little way. There's a heroic audacity to the spirituality of the little way. When put into practice, it turns out it's not very little at all. In fact, it's pretty damn hard to do, and you'd be heroic for even trying it. Want a real spiritual challenge? Want to be a radical follower of Jesus? Want to try something truly heroic? Try the little way. Try it and tell me if the little way isn't the most heroic and radical thing you've ever attempted in your life. Or consider Dorothy Day, the original social justice warrior, the most radical Catholic perhaps of the past 100 years, a giant of the faith who started the Catholic worker movement, the offspring of which is the Working Center just a few doors down. And when she first encountered the little way, she called it colorless, monotonous, too small, in fact, for my notice. But she changed her mind and said, this is the atom a small thing, and yet what havoc it has wrought. Is her little way a small contribution to the life of the Spirit? It has all the power of the Spirit of Christianity behind it. It has an explosive force that can transform our lives in the life of the world once put into effect. She went on to call it the democratization of holiness, because you don't have to be a celebrity or big name to practice it. Nobody has to be radical to do this. It's for people with jobs and mortgages and kids and packed calendars and trying to get from here to there and student debt and all of it. And the power of it, it's a practice, habit-forming practice that targets our emotions and affections. And so let me give you a little example from Therese. In fair warning, it will be underwhelming. But the underwhelming is the key to it. Because again, for Therese, what she's unpacking is the science of love. In her book, she describes the environment of her convent, and her environment was exactly like ours. In her world, some of the sisters she lived with were popular, others were not. Others were isolated because they were socially awkward. They were annoying. They were hard to get along with. This is what she says. I've noticed, and this is very natural, that the most saintly sisters are the most loved. We seek their company. We render them services without their asking. Finally, the soul so capable of bearing the lack of respect and consideration of others see themselves surrounded with everyone's affection. On the other hand, imperfect souls are not sought out. No doubt we remain within the limits of religious politeness in their regard, but we generally avoid them, fearing lest we say something which isn't too amiable. And I love, she goes on to describe these sisters, imperfect sisters, as people without good judgment, without good manners, touchiness in certain characters, and in all things they don't make life agreeable. How relatable is that? Think of all the people we try to avoid in life. And sure, we're polite, but all of the people we encounter in life who just don't make life agreeable. And she goes on, and it's kind of funny, she calls them social oddities with a chronic social sickness that there's no hope for a cure for. I find that hilarious and compelling, because I don't know about you, but for me, some people are just hard to get along with. I remember Sock Arm Custodian. I used to work with him, and he drove me nuts. Because he's one of those guys that knew everything. For every problem, he had an easy solution. And he was always just so trite and always thought he had the answers. And listen, there's a lot of people like that, but what drove me over the top with Sock Arm Custodian is that he wore a sock over his arm every day. Always the same, short sleeves and a sock on one arm. Just begging for you to ask, why are you wearing a sock on your arm? And when you did, he'd be like, well, I've got this condition where my left arm gets colder than my right, so I wear a sock on my arm. I don't even know what to say to that, because in life, it's little things like that that drive me nuts. Why don't you wear long sleeves like a normal person would? But no, you're wearing a sock on your arm. I try to avoid that guy at all costs. Or I think of the lady, I call her the throne her Bible lady. She drove me nuts. Every time I talked to her at church, she had this story, this traumatic event in her life where she got upset once and threw her Bible. And for 3 years, every time I talked to her, she's like, can we work through this incident where I threw my Bible? And I'm like, pick it up, dust it off, get over it. Like, that's not a traumatic event. But for her, it was just, I need to work through that I threw my Bible. And every time I talked to her, it would come up. And I'm just like, I can't handle you. This is driving me insane. And so I would avoid her. I'd avoid Sock Arm Custodian. This is what I'm talking about in life. Some people are just so annoying. It could be their awkward personality, some idiosyncrasy of theirs, their politics, their beliefs, their temperaments. This is what Therese is describing. Some people, ugh. But notice how her little way plays out. This is the conclusion I draw from this. I must seek out in recreation on free days the company of sisters who are the least agreeable to me in order to carry out with regard to these wounded souls the office of the Good Samaritan. A word, an amiable smile often suffice to make a sad soul bloom. And this is what I love about the little way. First, I think we tend to think of the Good Samaritan story as aid to people in obvious need, but I love how she sees it much bigger than that. There are souls, wounded souls, awkward souls in need of a Good Samaritan. And so she's already shifting how we think about love, but when I read those words, there's a moment where my heart sinks. She says we must seek out these people on our free days. In reading that line, I'm like, oh, no, here it comes again. I've got to not only add to my schedule, but not just add to it. I've got to add on my free day time with really annoying people. It's making me tired already, but I love how she finishes. It's like, whoa, wait. No. This isn't the big way of being Christian. This is the little way. Seek them out with the gift of a kind word, a smile. And we might think, that sounds like the smallest and most insignificant thing I've ever heard of. It is small. It requires adding nothing to our schedule, but what it forces us to do is to swim against the tide of our feelings and emotions. Instead of leaning away from these kind of people, it asks us to lean in, even in just the smallest of way. The little way of being Christian is about leaning in where we'd rather lean out. And act by act by act, it's a habit-forming practice, a discipline that teaches us to widen, make space for God in the stranger. It simply asks us, just expand your territory of kindness just a little, just a little. And so often, I think with hospitality, we think, oh, great, I've got to invite every homeless person I see downtown over for dinner, and I need to be involved in justice causes that feed the sick and the poor and give justice to prisoners and those who are naked and starving. And that's like asking us to throw like Kawhi Leonard. It ain't going to happen. And I think what the little way does is simply ask this, would you pick up the ball? Just pick up the ball. Find someone at work, someone you've ignored, someone you're just like, please, I don't want to talk to them. Say hello, a warm greeting, seek them out, a kind word, a smile, start there. The little way is a practice that anyone can do. It's not trying to fill up our schedule. It's trying to widen our hearts. A few weeks or months ago, I told you about Judo Dad. Yeah, a little run-in with him. For those of you that missed it, he outed me and tattled on me because my kid was making some noise, and so he went and tattled on me because my daughter was making noise, and we had a little thing. I'm like, what's the verdict, champ? And it was awkward, and it was not good. And I've been avoiding him, and yet I see him everywhere. I was at the optometrist. There he is. Oh, jeez. Every day at school, dropping off the kids, he's around, and I'm just like, ah. And then it finally happened. I've got this in my mind a little way, and we're picking up our kids from school one day, and he comes hurrying over, looking mean like he always does, and stands right beside me. I'm like, oh, Jesus, please. And all I did was stick up my hand and say, hey, I'm Brad. He shook my hand and said, Dave, we got off to a rough start. Sorry about that. And then he proceeded to tell me how his life feels hectic. He feels like an Uber driver without being paid because he's carting his kids all around. We had a wonderful little chat, and that was it. The little way. I don't need to pretend that Judo Dad's going to be my best friend. And I don't need to pretend that I'm going to invite Judo Dad over for dinner and his family and ours will go camping and we'll, you know, I don't need to pretend that. Just have to make an effort to lean in instead of leaning out. And that's what I love about the little way. Do you ever have days, though, where you're just grumpy and irritable? Days where you're just like more prickly and you feel mean and you're annoyed by the most petty of things? I'm assuming we all do. Therese had those days as well, and I love, even if it's a bit over the top, how her little way coaches her to deal with it. And here's an experience I can relate to that she records. She records a moment when a sister is making a clicking noise that's driving her insane. She says this, for a long time at evening meditation, I was placed in front of a sister who had a strange habit. As soon as the sister arrived, she began making a strange little noise which resembled the noise one would make when rubbing two shells, one against the other. It would be impossible for me to tell you how much this little noise wearied me. I had a great desire to turn my head and stare at the culprit who was very certainly unaware of her click. Oh, is that not life? Annoying clicks. I feel like my whole life is annoying clicks everywhere. Seems like something very small, and yet we all know this is the stuff of life, the annoyances we deal with when living and working with real annoying people. Remember, I had a teacher in high school, drove me nuts because he always had a little thing he did at the end of each sentence. It was a, okay. So he'd be like, take out your textbooks, turn it to page 32, okay. And you're going to look for this in the book, okay. After every sentence, okay. I was like, nails on a chalkboard, I can't stand you. Why do you stop it? Okay. Oh. Or this one time I'm in the theater, and I got a real etiquette in theaters. And I'm watching a movie, and there's a woman two rows in front of me, and she's got her phone on. She's texting, which is annoying enough. I see the light coming up for her thing. But then she gets a call, and she takes it. Right? There's no hope for someone like that. Like, they're beyond hope. If you pick up a call in the middle of a movie theater, there's something wrong with you. And I don't even care if the phone call is warning us that a tornado is barreling towards the theater. You take that call in the lobby, then you come back, tell us we're all in danger. I don't care what it is. She took the call. And I'm like, And she proceeded, it was like 5 minutes. Oh, really? Okay, all right. Anyway, yeah. Oh, my goodness, people like that, they drive me insane. We all know experiences like that, and I think we're tempted to act antisocially, to turn and glare at someone, communicate, your presence bothers me. But rather than glare her little way, it targets her feelings of invitation and tries to alter them. She says this, I remained calm, therefore, and tried to unite myself to God and to forget the little noise, but everything was useless. I felt the perspiration inundate me. I searched for a way of listening to the noise without annoyance and with peace and joy, at least in the interior of my soul. I tried to love the little noise, which was so displeasing. Instead of trying not to hear it, which was impossible, I paid close attention so as to hear it well, as though it were a delightful concert, and my prayer was spent offering this concert to Jesus. Again, she's a bit, whoo. But there's something there. What she's trying to do is target her feelings, her emotions. She's battling this feeling of annoyance and try to transform it into some kind of kindness and warmth and patience. And that's the thing, the nature of patience at its core. Patience is mastering our emotions in order to behave kindly towards others. Patience is giving the gift of kindness and love and hospitality when our emotions are screaming otherwise. It's telling our emotions, you're spoiled little brat, and you need to be harnessed right now. And that, my friends, is the little way. Being the heart of Christ, the love of Christ in every situation we encounter. And it's the key to this habit-forming discipline that asks us not to fill our calendars, but to practice love via a million boring little things. And it might sound small, but its effects can be atomic. And anyone I know who has tried the little way sings its praises. Life-changing. World-changing. Try to do every small thing you do today with great love. Try waiting in line at the grocery store with love. Try sitting in traffic with love. Try dealing with a screaming toddler with love. Try reading your social media feed with love. Right? And it might seem completely underwhelming to many of us, but let me again share the words of Beck. There's a heroic audacity to the spirituality of the little way. When put into practice, it turns out it's not very little at all. In fact, it's pretty damn hard to do, and you'd be heroic for even trying it. Want a real spiritual challenge? Want to be a radical follower of Jesus? Want to try something truly heroic? Try the little way. Try it and tell me if the little way isn't the most heroic and radical thing you've ever attempted in your life. So try it. 6 months, this summer, a year. Try it and see how it works. I want to show you a video in a second, but what I found in my life practicing the little way is that it always is incredibly challenging, but an awakeness to it. I was in the airport on Friday, and of course, airports try your patience. And the most of the times, and I sat down next to a woman in the waiting room, and she just would not stop talking. And I don't know about you, but when I'm in line or waiting at an airport, I really just want to be alone with my misery and just feel the warmth of being angry at the world. And she's just talking to me, and I'm trying to be polite, and I want to just look down at my phone. I want to pretend to use the bathroom even though I don't have to go, but it's just a little thing. Wait. Maybe lean in instead of away. And it might not change anything drastically, but it's little things like that that I think begin to change our heart. And in 2005, David Foster Wallace, he gave a commencement speech, which I think is one of the greatest commencement speeches ever. For those of you who are young or in college, university here, this may be particularly meaningful for you, but I think it's poignant for all of us. And David Foster Wallace was influenced by Teresa's little way, and I think he really gets at it here in this video. And so I want to show you this. It's a short clip, 10 minutes I think it is, but I think this will give you a different lens to see the little way through. So can we play that now?
There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" The point of the fish story is merely that the most obvious, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. Stated as an English sentence, of course, this is just a banal platitude. But the fact is that in the day-to-day trenches of adult existence, banal platitudes can have a life or death importance. The plain fact is that you graduating seniors do not yet have any clue what day in, day out really means. There happen to be whole, large parts of adult American life that nobody talks about in commencement speeches. One such part involves boredom, routine, and petty frustration. The parents and older folks here will know all too well what I'm talking about. By way of example, let's say it's an average adult day, and you get up in the morning, go to your challenging white-collar college graduate job, and you work hard for 8 or 10 hours, and at the end of the day you're tired and somewhat stressed, and all you want is to go home and have a good supper and maybe unwind for an hour and then hit the sack early, because of course you have to get up the next day and do it all again. Then you remember there's no food at home. You haven't had time to shop this week because of your challenging job. And so now, after work, you have to get in your car and drive to the supermarket. It's the end of a work day, and the traffic is apt to be very bad. So getting to the store takes way longer than it should. And when you finally get there, the supermarket is very crowded, because of course it's the time of day when all the other people with jobs also try to squeeze in some grocery shopping. But you can't just get in and quickly out. You have to wander all over the huge, overlit store's confusing aisles to find the stuff you want. And you have to maneuver your junky cart through all these other tired, hurried people with carts, etc., etc., cutting stuff out because it's a long ceremony. And eventually, you get all your supper supplies, except now it turns out there aren't enough checkout lanes open, even though it's the end of the day rush. So the checkout line is incredibly long, which is stupid and infuriating, but you can't take your frustration out on the frantic lady working the register, who is overworked at a job whose daily tedium and meaninglessness surpasses the imagination of any of us here at a prestigious college. But anyway, you finally get to the checkout line's front, and you pay for your food, and get told to have a nice day in a voice that is the absolute voice of death. And then you have to take your creepy, flimsy plastic bags of groceries in your cart with the one crazy wheel that pulls maddeningly to the left, all the way out through the crowded, bumpy, littery parking lot. And then you have to drive all the way home through slow, heavy, SUV-intensive rush hour traffic, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone here has done this, of course, but it hasn't yet been part of you graduates' actual life routine, day after week, after month, after year. But it will be. And many more dreary, annoying, seemingly meaningless routines besides. But that is not the point. The point is that petty, frustrating crap like this is exactly where the work of choosing is going to come in. Because the traffic jams and crowded aisles and long checkout lines give me time to think. And if I don't make a conscious decision about how to think and what to pay attention to, I'm going to be pissed and miserable every time I have to shop. Because my natural default setting is the certainty that situations like this are really all about me. About my hungriness and my fatigue and my desire to just get home. And it's going to seem, for all the world, like everybody else is just in my way. And who are all these people in my way? And look at how repulsive most of them are, and how stupid and cow-like and dead-eyed and non-human they seem in the checkout line. Or at how annoying and rude it is that people are talking loudly on cell phones in the middle of the line. And look at how deeply, personally unfair this is. If I choose to think this way in the store and on the freeway, fine. Lots of us do. Except thinking this way tends to be so easy and automatic that it doesn't have to be a choice. It is my natural default setting. It's the automatic way that I experience the boring, frustrating, crowded parts of adult life when I'm operating on the automatic, unconscious belief that I am the center of the world and that my immediate needs and feelings are what should determine the world's priorities. The thing is that, of course, there are totally different ways to think about these kinds of situations. In this traffic, all these vehicles stuck and idling in my way, it's not impossible that some of these people in SUVs have been in horrible auto accidents in the past and now find driving so terrifying that their therapist has all but ordered them to get a huge, heavy SUV so they can feel safe enough to drive. Or I can choose to force myself to consider the likelihood that everyone else in the supermarket's checkout line is just as bored and frustrated as I am, and that some of these people probably have much harder, more tedious, or painful lives than I do. Again, Please don't think I'm giving you moral advice, or that I'm saying you're supposed to think this way, or that anyone expects you to just automatically do it, because it's hard. It takes will and effort. And if you are like me, some days you won't be able to do it, or you just flat out won't want to. But most days, if you're aware enough to give yourself a choice, you can choose to look differently at this fat, dead-eyed, over-made-up lady who just screamed at her kid in the checkout line. Maybe she's not usually like this. Maybe she's been up 3 straight nights holding the hand of her husband who's dying of bone cancer. Or maybe this very lady is the low-wage clerk at the motor vehicles department who just yesterday helped your spouse resolve a horrific, infuriating red tape problem through some small act of bureaucratic kindness. Of course, none of this is likely, but it's also not impossible. It just depends what you want to consider. If you're automatically sure that you know what reality is and who and what is really important, if you want to operate on your default setting, then you, like me, probably won't consider possibilities that aren't annoying and miserable. But if you really learn how to think, how to pay attention, then you will know you have other options. It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell-type situation as not only meaningful, but sacred, on fire with the same force that lit the stars, love, fellowship, the mystical oneness of all things deep down. Not that that mystical stuff's necessarily true. The only thing that's capital T true is that you get to decide how you're going to try to see it. This, I submit, is the freedom of real education, of learning how to be well-adjusted. You get to consciously decide what has meaning and what doesn't. That is real freedom. That is being educated and understanding how to think. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. I know that this stuff probably doesn't sound fun and breezy or grandly inspirational the way a commencement speech is supposed to sound. What it is, as far as I can see, is the capital T truth with a whole lot of rhetorical niceties stripped away. You are, of course, free to think of it whatever you wish. But please don't just dismiss it as some finger-wagging Dr. Laura sermon. None of this stuff is really about morality or religion or dogma or big fancy questions of life after death. The capital T truth is about life before death. It is about the real value of a real education, which has almost nothing to do with knowledge and everything to do with simple awareness. Awareness of what is so real and essential, so hidden in plain sight all around us all the time, that we have to keep reminding ourselves over and over, this is water. This is water.
I love that last line, what is so real and essential is often hidden in plain sight all around us all the time. And I would go one step farther than Wallace and say that Jesus, who is ultimate reality, in my mind, capital T truth, is often hidden in plain sight all around us all the time. And I got to be honest with you, I've reached this weird point in my life where I no longer believe in any kind of revolution except this one. The revolution of the ordinary and its capacity to change us and our world. Because I'm done and tired and weary of the big ways of our world, the big way of social revolution, the big way of being Christian. For me, I just no longer believe that's where the magic is. I think the real magic is in transforming the ordinary, practicing the little way of seeing Christ all around us and committing to loving in a million boring little ways. Let's pray and then we'll go from here in peace. God, thank you for Therese and her life in this little way she has shown us of being Christian. And God, it's not easy to be aware and see and love in the ordinary. It feels overwhelming. But by your Spirit, would you guide us and prompt us and remind us to wake up, to see you hidden in the strangers all around us. And so may we be Christians of the little way. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Go in peace.